kind of system do we live in? We live in a capitalist system, but it's a specific form of capitalism. The American system of capitalism. People are afraid of losing their status in the society. We were born capitalists. All those dynamics are constantly swirling in the American imagination. This is Dr. Edgar Rivera Colón, and this is Karl Marx, Ape My Field Notes. Welcome, all my friends out there in podcast land, to Karl Marx, Ape My Field Notes. I'm Edgar Rivera Colón, and this is our third episode. During our last episode, we ended talking about this question of growing our souls, or the time has come to grow our souls, which is in the next, that term or that phrase comes from the Next American Revolution by Grace Lee Boggs. And I'll talk a little bit more about Professor Grace Lee Boggs, although I really should call her doctor, because she was never a full-time professor. She was a full-time activist and thinker and writer and organizer. So also, just to remind you, we do have an email if you want to make comments or suggestions or have any opinions that you'd like to share with the show. It's kmarx8, K-M-A-R-X, 8 as in eating a sandwich, A-T-E at gmail.com, and drop us a line. We'd love to hear your comments. So today we're going to talk about growing our souls, but first I have to go back and think about this question of using terms and sort of building up our vocabulary. Part of the exercise that we're doing in this podcast is to build up our analytical thinking skills, feeling skills, and that will result in some kind of action on our part with other people. At the core of this is sort of an idea that we grow as people through social practice with others that are consciously committed to certain ways of living in the world and being in the world. So we'll get more into that as time goes on. But I just want to say that the key thing about any podcast, and certainly mine is within that camp, is that it's reaching out to people to provoke discussion, to provoke reflection, self-reflection, but ultimately collective reflection, which is the important thing, I think, as we're living in these Trumpian times. You'll notice that in the podcast, I don't spend a lot of time talking about current events, because I think that's really become a machine of distraction for people. What more outrageous thing could the Trump administration and Trump himself do? So I think that's a deflective mechanism. And I think that people have become so used to the outrageous, it's no longer outrageous. So I think what I'm going to try to do, or what I'm, you know, sort of the 2 cents I'm going to add to the discussion, is to develop our capacity to think harder, think better, feel deeper, and act in the world in more purposeful ways with other people, and also to deepen our sense of this notion that I'm always thinking about, which is political love. So let's just start with some terms. So last time I talked about unity, and some of my listeners were talking about that. Why don't you repeat that? Okay. So basically, the idea of unity, there's what I would call false unity, where people pretend to be united, but they have all these internal conflicts that they haven't recognized, or group conflicts they haven't recognized. But the unity I'm talking about is a process of collective recognition of shared concrete needs that are differential. That was what people were asking about. What do you mean by differential? What I mean by that is that people have needs, but they respond to them and need them satisfied differently. To use a real simple example, if we're living in a society where healthcare is no longer a commodity, wouldn't that be nice? My Lord, that would be partially sort of like heaven if we just get rid of that. Healthcare is a commodity, but it's a right that everyone has access to. Clearly, someone who needs dialysis has needs that, for example, I wouldn't have, or some person who doesn't have kidney failure wouldn't have. So certainly we have shared needs, but some people have different needs that need to be responded differently. That's what I really meant. So instead of looking for some kind of theoretical unity, we should try to look for, okay, what are the needs that we have? And we know those change. There's some fundamental needs that we all need as animals, as human beings, but there are other needs that develop historically in time. So what are those? And how could we address them in a way that doesn't try to make a simple uniformity where everyone gets the same stuff, because people may need different things, need different resources, because they have different needs, huh? So it's a recognition of concrete shared needs and the processes by which we're gonna get to that place where people's needs are satisfied. So that was the first thing I wanted to talk about today. I wanna talk about this question of unity. We could keep on adding to that idea of unity being about concrete recognition of concrete shared needs that are differential, that have this difference part inside of it. And I also talked about the idea that capitalism exploits us, that it the system that we live in, that's American capitalism, extracts value from us. That's literally the term. But I like the idea of labor power, that we have a power that's rooted in our bodies and our minds and our spirits. And that power can create things and create all kinds of things. We're one of the few species that can actually alternate the very environment that produced us. And we've seen both the good and the not so good aspects of that in this very day, where we know that the Brazilian Amazon is on fire and in danger of really destroying enormous amounts of life. So we're thinking about that today, right? But again, that's being done by people seeking resources and corporations seeking resources as well, not within the limits of sustainability. So that's one thing. We're all exploited under capitalism. Those of us who work are. And the other thing that I was talking about, and people asked me about this last time, was, well, what about this question of productive power? Use that term, productive power. What do you mean by that? Well, think about it this way. Society has different modes of power. Power, the ability to get a group of people to do what you want them to do, right? Or to one group of people to get another group of people to do what that group wants them to do, whether it's in their interest or not. And there's a what we would call a repressive, centralized notion of power. So the power's located in the police or in the military or in the banking system, and it's in one place. That's one way of thinking about it, and you can get a lot of places from there. But there's another piece, and this is the writings of someone like Michel Foucault, who was this French philosopher, basically a philosopher who thought about his historical problems. And one of the things he did was think about power as productive, as that people actually, when we think about power, they see their, let's say, sexuality or their identity or their consumption as constituting themselves. And I'm not saying sexuality is, you know, not part of that. But what I'm saying is that power can be thought of as not centralized, but almost in a network, a matrix, if you will, right? The Matrix, think about that movie. And that we're all in it and we all have a share in it, but we're all constituted by it. And so power can feel good, even if it's against your interest in the long run. And that's what I was trying to say, that you can't just think that, you know, people are like puppets and they're being manipulated. But rather, and well, actually, people do get manipulated. We know that for a fact in life, right? There's propaganda, advertising. Advertising is all about, basically manipulating people into buying things. For those who are interested in this, there's a book called Literally Propaganda by Edward Bernays, who was really the master of American advertising and marketing. So there's that part of it, but there's also this other part where people invest in the very idea, right? So why did I bring that up? Because I think I brought it up because I was thinking about our friend Antonio Gramsci. And Gramsci is one of these people who was thinking, well, you know, here we are in Italy. Why didn't we have a revolution in the most advanced sectors of Europe? We had it in Russia, which is sort of a backward place compared to a place like France or Germany or Italy itself. Why would the revolution not occur in Germany or in England? You know, where you have all these conditions, where you have these workers, you have many more workers in Germany than you do in terms of Russia. They have unions. Well, one of the basic answers was that the way the ruling classes, the elites that ran the society, the market and the state were able to get people to consent through the idea of hegemony. That you didn't have to dominate people every day, but you can get them to consent that the way the society is with all its problems is commonsensical. It makes sense. It's practical. It's the best way to be. So when we think about that, what Gramsci says technically is like, well, there's political society. We can think about all the organs of the state that can be used to impose power, right? And then he says there's civil society, all these other non-state things like the church. It could be education, it could be ideology, culture, that actually get people to consent to the system as it is. And it could, again, when I'm saying people consenting to the system as it is, they could have critiques. They could say, well, this needs to be fixed, as I said earlier, but they basically affirm the rightness of the system. This is the best possible we could have at this moment. And you'll see that hegemony is more important in places like advanced capitalist societies because you have this huge media network that's constantly manipulating consciousness. The thing about capitalism, it just doesn't just produce nice shoes. It does actually produce nice shoes or good food. It does, or technology. It produces consciousness, forms of consciousness, forms of thinking yourself as a person that correspond to the basic power arrangements of the city, of the society, that are aligned with the fundamental power arrangements. Often, I, as a social scientist, people will say, well, what would you do if with this or that problem? I could give my opinion, but the minute I start giving my opinion, I'm also acting like a technocrat. I'm acting like, well, you know, we should manage this or that way. I don't think that's a good approach because it's not fundamentally democratic. And besides that, why should we who are in the opposition give another plan for them, these people who run the society, to manage their inequality, right? Maybe at the root of it is changing the whole system itself. So hegemony. So I just wanted to bring that back. And I used to use that term meritocracy, which is basically the idea that very deep in the United States that people get to the positions of their lives through hard work and merit. All I have to say about that is Donald Trump is president. And if you still believe that meritocracy exists in the United States, I have a wonderful little bridge in Brooklyn that I'm willing to sell you. Or I'm willing to sell you the Bayonne Bridge, which is not too far from my home in Jersey City. So the other, you know, so when we're thinking about these things, we're building a vocabulary. We're building a way of seeing. And one of the points of our last episode was to understand that idea of ideology, that it's a belief system, it's a way of thinking about the world that justifies the set of power relationships that we have. So, and it's deep, it's a very deep thing. When we think about gender ideologies, those are very deep things. They even structure the way we perceive the world in terms of knowledge. So in the university, there are soft sciences like sociology and my own anthropology, and hard sciences like physics and chemistry. Think about the sexist sort of frame of that. You know, that soft is feminine, hard is masculine. So it really goes through our whole consciousness, this question of ideology, which gender is one part of it, race is another, class is another. So one of the points that I was sort of emphasizing last time was this idea that, well, that ideology breaks your heart, that it just doesn't go to the kind of rational argument, but it goes to what I was calling that feeling space, that space that engages your heart, that engages your fantasies, your images, your mind. One way to put this is ideologies are thoughts that justify political power, but they do it by corralling your gut, your groins, right? And your feelings and your heart, all of it, right? And that's what I meant by like a whole body system of socialization, of getting you to agree. So we know that we are sexual beings. We have a gut, we have all the, and so ideology works at all those levels. Okay, so that was just figuring out for the moment some of the terms I didn't get a chance to sort of go through. And I teased you a little bit in terms of saying that one of the things that we need to do in trying to challenge the present set of ideologies we're under in the United States, and we can go through them. Exceptionalism, right? White supremacy, sexism, patriarchy, homophobia, transphobia, all these ideologies that encircle us, in one sense, inform and limit our imaginations. One way to think about it is to grow our souls, which is a sort of an odd thing. Why would a Marxist like me want to have people grow their souls, right? Aren't you guys atheists? Well, in this case, I'm not an atheist, but let's think about this question of soul and what people mean by soul. And I'm going to read you a little quote from our venerable ancestor in struggle, Grace Lee Boggs. Grace Lee Boggs got a PhD in philosophy at Bryn Mawr in German philosophy, and, you know, read German, knew Marx inside out, and was an activist in the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s and the 80s, up until the 21st century, working on the feminist movement, the Black liberation struggle, environmental, urban environmentalism, the labor movement. So she sort of remained someone to return to and had a long life and wrote, although she never had a university position. So this is a selection from an essay she writes in her book, The Next American Revolution. And just attend to the words because they're very powerful. And the essay is called, These Are the Times to Grow Our Souls. Quote, these are the times that try our souls. Each of us needs to undergo a tremendous philosophical and spiritual transformation. Each of us needs to be awakened to a personal and compassionate recognition of the inseparable interconnection between our minds, hearts, and bodies, between our physical and psychical well-being, and between ourselves and all the other selves in our country and in the world. Each of us needs to stop being a passive observer of the suffering that we know is going on in the world and start identifying with the sufferers. Each of us needs to make a leap that is both practical and philosophical, beyond determinism to self-determination. Each of us has to be true to and enhance our own humanity by embracing and practicing the conviction that as human beings, we have free will. So she talks about the time has come to grow our souls. And there's a couple of questions to ask in this. First of all is to identify the suffering in the world, our suffering and the suffering of other people, the recognition of it, not to be a passive observer of it, and to begin this question of spiritually and politically and psychically growing and acting on this question of free will. So let's get into this question of soul a little bit, because I think you could get confused. A lot of notions of the soul are like a ghost in a machine, like, you know, we have our body and we have our soul. But actually, there are more sophisticated notions of what the soul is that are ancient sources, but when you read them today, you say, oh, wow, they were sort of ahead of their time. Let's imagine, as a thought experiment, that the soul is basically a place where you have knowledge and action and motion going on. Knowledge, action, motion. And that all things that have intelligence, that act in the world and move, have soul. So the soul that she's talking about is the soul that develops when people come together and begin to identify their needs, look at their context, and act together. The soul doesn't occur in the individual as if it's like, you know, hooked in there through some kind of like, you know, Casper type of deal, some kind of spirit, but rather that the spirit is produced through when people get together and create, labor, think, and transform themselves and the world around them. And part of that is recognizing that, and this is going to be hard for people to sort of understand, but let's try it. We're not quite human yet. We're in the process of becoming human beings. We're creating the conditions to become human beings. And what's most human about us, our capacity to think, our capacity to feel, our capacity to act in the world, our capacity to recognize responsibilities to others, our ability to labor and be creative, those things are used in a very narrow way in our society, largely for profit and survival. But we haven't come to the point where we're using it to really transform ourselves politically, economically, culturally, socially, and spiritually. So growing our souls becomes a revolutionary act, becomes a way of thinking about it. What I notice in Trump's America is how profoundly soulless it is, or it's becoming. And you can see it in the sort of loneliness that people experience all the time in this country. The tension between this idea that I'm going to do it on my own and the reality that we're all interconnected, all interdependent, and locked up and entangled at each other at all levels. So I think that when we think about growing our souls, consider that you would have to begin to develop a different ideology, a different way of looking at things. Gramsci would call it a counter-hegemony, a counter way of understanding the world, so you don't keep on replicating the same ideas that are just basically instruments of profit, causes of suffering, and ways in which people aren't allowed to begin to love, to begin to lift the barriers, the thing that makes us most human, which is really the capacity to love and create. So that's what I meant when I said that when we think about, or when we're trying to think beyond our field notes, right? Karl Marx has stolen our field notes, that dastardly Marx. What do we do when we begin to realize that the key thing to revolution, to revolutionary spirits, to revolutionary projects, to freedom projects, really, to use the old American expression, freedom projects, is the self-development of people in a collective process of development. That's the core, right? That's what we're aiming towards. And if we don't do that, that what we're doing is not realizing ourselves as full human beings. So people will say, well, how can you say that we're not human beings yet? Well, we are Homo sapiens. I mean, no one's going to argue against that. We're modern Homo sapiens. But the idea of humanity is just not, this is what it is and that's all it is. It's the capacity to develop in a human way that is distinct from, let's say, ants, radically distinct from birds. Right? That's the key thing. And a lot of the younger writings of Marx is all about that. All about that. The problem with capitalism is that it alienates us. It makes us alone. It makes us alienated from the most important thing, the work of our hands, the fruit of our labor. We no longer get the full return on it. Someone else profits, and a small group of people live incredibly, obscenely rich lives, billions and billions of dollars, while the majority of humanity struggles day to day. That's what I mean. That what we need to become is free. We can only do that together. And the only way to sort of develop that is through a question of self-development, discovering needs, and developing a political project for freedom. We're living in a realm of unfreedom in Trump's America, and people are being constantly targeted, and we're living in a dangerous period politically. So when I say, let us grow our souls, or let us work on the question of growing our souls, what I mean is that love is the most important form of revolutionary political labor, and that's the basis for a lot of the transformations we need. But you also have to have the capacity to do what Latin American political revolutionaries talk about when they say that this is a term called coyuntura política. What does that mean? What is the actual conjuncture politically? We have to have the capacity to sit down and see what's our situation, what are the capacities that we have at our disposal, and what are the capacities we need to develop in order to get to the next stage of our own development. You have to be able to do analysis. And part of the scam of Trump, the what I would call world historical three-card Monte game that's being played on the American people is their inability to do analysis, to do real fundamentally grounded analysis that is also infused with the ethic of love. And I think that's one of the reasons I have this show. I could never imagine myself having a podcast, but the only reason I'm having it is because the times call for all kinds of forms of communication and education. And next time, what we'll talk about is this question of, well, how do we develop these capacities? What are they? What are the skills we need? And we're beginning to establish a critical vocabulary around ideology and hegemony. But we need to get there in a way that we can begin to use the tools that we're developing in this podcast and in your lives to change our lived reality. And so that's it for today, episode 3. And just remember that through living hard, thinking hard, and loving hard, we're going to change this place called America. Thank you. Have a good day.